You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Onyx Hunt and Onyx Maps. Now, I got to have a little heart-to-heart with you here real quick. I used Onyx Maps on my phone every single day during the hunting season, whether I was out west during my elk hunt, South Dakota mule deer hunt, or my rut vacation in Iowa. I was on my phone using Onyx Maps every part of the day, whether I was looking at terrain features on the topographic and satellite maps that they offer on their app, or if I was leaving a waypoint like a watering hole, or where I left my trail cameras or tree stands, or if I was marking a route from a campsite to a glassing position, or from my truck to a tree stand location. I used Onyx Maps every single day, and I feel like it's an app that made my life a little bit easier. I don't know about you, but there's been times in the past where I have been trying to find a tree stand based off of memory and not off of looking at a map. And I have gotten lost in the dark before. I had to wait till sunup and then you know, find it that way. But that problem does not exist anymore because of Onyx, and there's a ton of other features that I think you guys need to check out. Go to onyxmaps.com and check out all the functionality of the app. Download it to your phone, give it a try, and when you do decide to purchase, enter the discount code NATION20, NATION20, and for new users, you're going to receive 20% off. So, onyxmaps.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
This is a podcast that I'm real excited about. Matt's not with us this week. He's traveling, consulting. Of course, kind of a little heads up to you guys. Prepare yourself for a lot of podcasts when it's just myself and a guest and Matt and a guest, or Matt on the road and me in the office, or vice versa, because this is consulting season. And so Matt is out consulting in West Virginia and Ohio this week. I leave for Illinois. I'll be in Illinois when this podcast drops. And so we've got a lot of traveling ahead of us, and lots of hopefully habitat to be put on the ground. So I have returning guest, my brother, Chad. Thanks for coming back.
It's funny you say it's consulting season for you. It's another C word for me. It's chainsaw season.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely the time of the year, and you know, we ran a saw for a good bit 2 days ago, you and I doing some edge feathering and putting in a bedding thicket on a part of the farm that's been neglected over the years. And guys, it is chainsaw season. It's still bow season. The heck with that.
It's muzzleloader season. I shot a doe last night.
Alternative season here in Missouri, but it's also a very, very great time to be putting habitat on the ground. I think, so to give you guys an idea, this whole podcast, because we've made so many social media posts and also some videos coming out on our YouTube channel. So here's my little plug, guys. It's the time of the year where a lot of guys are starting to transition back into habitat work. Go to our YouTube channel, Land and Legacy. Please subscribe. That's one big way you can help support this channel. We've got some videos dropping that have dropped and more to come in the future as soon as I get them edited on certain things like edge feathering. And because we've talked so much about edge feathering, we're going to devote this entire podcast to edge feathering. And so it's chainsaw season, which means that you can be doing some phenomenal edge feathering. And maybe we ought to prioritize the work for you guys. Last week we talked about year in the life of a land manager. we gave you a long list of things to do to improve the your property. And it's really a long list, but it's really not too bad for if you were to look at that and just say 2 years, I'm going to follow this. I'm going to do everything they said. In 2 years, your whole place has changed. But this week, we're really talking about edge feathering and why it's important. All things edge feathering. Got anything you want to add to that before we jump in?
Not really.
So, with edge feathering, it's almost I feel like edge feathering is like, when do you think you first heard about edge feathering? You were looking into land wildlife management long before I was, because I was 7 years old.
I don't even.
I'm trying to think the first time.
I probably saw it in some of the quail, like the quail information from NDC.
Yeah.
And it's available to people in other states too. The Missouri Department of Conservation puts out a ton of great quail habitat information.
They do.
I mean, some great pamphlets, all kinds of information on things you can do that not only benefit your quail, they're going to benefit everything.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one thing we've said it over and over on the podcast, but we'll say it again because it's just kind of a repetitive. I feel sometimes it's very repetitive, but it's so important that we keep pounding it out there and keep giving that information. But when it comes to edge feathering and the benefits to so many other species, that's one of the reasons why we love it so much, and one of the reasons why we love the micro clear cuts or the bedding thickets, because it's beneficial to all sorts of different species. But we've said it, and we'll say it again. If you were a deer hunter and you were solely focused on deer and you wanted to say one of the phrases I hate, I only care about big deer. Okay, if you said that in the past, slap yourself, all right? Now, if you were to say, I only care about big deer, let's then go and say, okay, that could be your mindset, but if I'm really focused on making this as good as I could for my big deer, go ahead and say, okay, but let's focus on quail if I'm in a region that has bobwhite quail. And you were to just devote the next 5 years to only doing habitat work for quail, your deer would do probably better than your food plot mineral program that you have going. They would do incredibly well off of focusing on habitat work for bobwhite quail.
I don't know that you could say it too many times that you're going to see way better benefits to your deer in managing your property for quail than you will ever see from supplemental feeding and food plots.
Yeah.
But mainstream, that's what's pushed.
Yeah. It's easy to sell a bag of mineral or a block of mineral, or it's easy to stick a deer on the bag or even food plot seed. And we love food plots. But you don't see us neglecting our habitat to go to food plots. They go hand in hand for us. It's a hunting strategy for food plots. But and let's just say you're in the northern part of the world where you don't have bobwhite quail, and you're like, well, I'm still managing for deer. Okay, well, just say that you're managing for rough grouse. I know I've said that in the past. Like, you're trying to create that disturbance, a healthy forest, which is only going to create more food, more cover, more habitat for white-tailed deer. So don't give me an excuse that you can't focus on some of these other species that really need good habitat. A deer is so adaptable that the habitat can be poor, and they're going to adapt to it, change their range, do something, but they're probably still going to be there. A quail ain't. If you don't have good quail habitat, it's gone. You don't have them. But if you make really, really great quail habitat,
the deer
are going to do so good.
Your deer are going to flourish. Your turkeys are going to flourish. Everything is. And that's what, I mean, we've already kind of planned out some of the stuff we're going to talk about in this, but the benefits of the edge feathering are, there's numerous benefits to whitetail deer.
Yep.
In this edge feathering.
Yes. And not only whitetail deer. Like we use edge feathering as a way to enhance the habitat, improve the habitat, provide a diversity within your farm by creating different plant communities or enhancing it to where there's a diversity of plant communities.
But here's one that on the farm, on these food plots that we have edge feathered, what's one thing you and I have talked about seeing?
Way more deer activity on those. Oh.
Nonstop food plots. Not dealing with deer.
Okay.
What's the other thing we have seen almost nonstop?
Rabbits?
Yes.
Yeah.
You can't walk into those food plots that we've done a lot of edge feathering and not see rabbits.
Yeah, especially on trail camera. I'll share a picture coming up, but we've got that photo series of a rabbit bouncing around on the edge of a food plot, and then all of a sudden a coyote shows up, and then 30 minutes later a coyote's running off with a rabbit in its mouth. Compare that. Now, a lot of our stuff, like a lot of our information, we look at university research. Dr. Craig Harper's got a lot of great has done a lot of great research that we just love and adapted in our management system. But then there's a lot of what we do that's based on real world school of hard knocks. That's going, yeah, we tried that. That didn't work. Or that was a huge waste of time. Or that really set us back. Or, man, that really made our deer hunting so much better, and we're noticing more of this or noticing more of that. That obviously was great for the land. Edge feathering is one of those that universities, when the U.S. government has cost-share options to motivate landowners to do edge feathering, that should tell you something that even they've noticed it being better. Yeah. And so, to me, it's like the lost art of edge feathering. In deer world, like I've said this once and I'll say it again, fellas, if you're a deer guy and you want to pride yourself in being a great deer manager, if you're a great habitat manager, then you should be noticing some more key species. Like if person A is a quote or self-proclaimed great deer guy and he doesn't have quail, and then person B is a great thinks of himself as a quail hunter and he's got quail everywhere, he's probably got big deer, he's a better habitat manager than the guy, person A, who's claiming to be a great habitat manager.
We've both seen habitat people preach against edge feathering. Preach against it.
Because it's aesthetic.
It's a predator strip.
Yeah.
But they forget to mention the fact that your woods should also be great habitat and not closed canopy and open.
Yes.
It's a system of things. You can't just go in and do edge feathering and expect all to be saved. You can't go in and do that.
No.
You have to be managing your whole property and not just your food plots.
Yeah. I think you'd make the mistake, and that's where prioritizing and going, okay, you go in, you put in your food plots. Great. You're trying to make a great hunting strategy. And then if you just did the edge feathering and you didn't touch any of the other stuff, sure, you're gonna notice deer bedding right next to your food plot because that's the best cover in the area. Not ideal.
They're gonna fawn in that.
Yeah.
You're gonna have nesting in that. Of course, that's gonna draw predators.
Yeah.
If you're not managing the rest of your property.
Yeah, but at the same time, at least if you have a 10-row strip, usually if you do edge feathering correctly, and you don't then look at it and say, "Boy, I could get 10 more yards of my food plot." And you end up pushing it out. If you do edge feathering correctly and you're worried about predators now running along, and you still are giving the fawns or a mama doe a better chance at raising a fawn by having more adequate habitat than if you were to live by you're just creating a predator strip and not do it anyway.
I just thought of another one that I guess you should preface this with you've posted enough pictures on edge feathering that people should realize what it is, but with social media you see all kinds of just garbage.
Yeah, we should say
I saw a picture posted a while back, and I've seen it a couple times, of talking about edge feathering, which I would call reverse edge feathering, where they'd went in to the timber and cut the trees out to plant their food plot farther into the timber. That's not edge feathering.
Yep.
That's putting a food plot in the shade. That's not edge feathering.
No, edge feathering, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this and paint a picture for somebody, but it's like the name says, we're feathering the edge.
It's changing the transition from one habitat type to another. And a lot of times you see a crop field going right into mature forest. And so that would be basically a two-layer edge, in my opinion. And I'm not sure anybody's talked about the layers of edge, but that's just what we do for simplicity's sake. You've got a two-layer edge. You've got crop field, pasture ground, or food plot, which is, it could be 6 inches tall to lip high, whatever it is. You've got one layer. And then you go into another edge or ecosystem landscape, and that's the mature forest. So it's really a cliff.
Like a single step.
A single step in a staircase or a cliff. You're falling off. I like what you said earlier. It's a cliff. And feathering, edge feathering is trying to make it have more steps in that staircase. So it could be going from mature forest down to young forest, down to shrubs, down to brambles, down to grasses and forbs to food plot. And so that's feathering the edge. You're trying to take a cliff and change it into, it could be 30 yards, it could be 10 yards, it could be 50 yards, and where you have multiple steps gradually falling down into the food plot or crop ground or pasture. So that's edge feathering. When we're talking historical, the historical side of it, we're talking trying to replicate nature. And so bear with me, we'll give a little bit of a trip down history lane. If you look at historical landscape, go a web soil survey, and you find prairie or grassland, whatever it is, and then you find forest somewhere else. If you look in between what was grassland to forest ground, you're going to see a transition. And that transition is going to be oak savanna, oak woodland, woodland, mixed. Basically, it's like, it's a mixture. So if you were to color coordinate that, you're going to go from white of grassland to black of timber. And somewhere in the middle, you got a lot of gray. And that's what we're looking at. Of oak savanna, oak woodland, you've got a mix of grasses and forbs and trees, transition into more of a forest, more of a tree-dominated landscape to transition back all the way over to more of a grassland, forb-dominated landscape. And that's what we're trying to do, but on a micro scale of feathering the edge. So
it honestly naturally exists very little anymore. Very, very little.
Yeah.
The places that I see it the most are like the Flint Hills in Kansas, where they still do large, burn it by the section, and let it rip right into the timber.
And I think one of those big differences on those historical landscapes were wildlife had such a big range. Herd animals. They herded up and they moved around. Like, everything moved in a very major scale. We're trying to create a very small ecosystem on our farm. And so instead of having this drastic miles and miles of an edge, and it could be even, it could be as simple as a grassland and forest, and the fire, as a fire swept across that prairie, it was a big raging fire, but as it hit kind of going into more trees, more woody stems, the fire wasn't as severe because of the intensity of the amount of fuel load. You know, you go from short grass prairie to tall grass prairie, tons of fuel. Fire rips across the grassland, if you've ever witnessed that. And then it slams into, what we're doing is slamming that into the forest, and you're going to get top-killed trees, stump sprouts, and that's a softer edge. We're replicating that with a chainsaw.
Yeah, I mean, it's just naturally you're going to have that process stopped when you chunk the land up the way it's been chunked up.
Yes.
It was a large-scale process in nature historically where the fire could go for long distances and rip into these things. Now it's so chunked up. Even in the prairies now, the prairie sections that we have, like Matt and I went the other day, you could see that somewhat of that edge feather where it's the shrubby cover coming out. But just the way that we manage our prairies now, there's very little heavy burning into that timber.
Because
it doesn't slam into it.
The prairies I've been on in Missouri are like a square mile or half square mile where you've got a roadway in the way.
Yeah.
And then it goes to private ground.
Yeah. So it's very little of that actual where it goes into the timber where it does step to a savanna or woodland type setting.
Yep.
It goes straight to close canopy timber again.
Yep. And so, you know, historically, we're just replicating that by feathering the edge
with a chainsaw and then reintroduce fire to keep it maintained. But we're trying to, as it all comes down, what are we trying to do? We're trying to add diversity on the landscape, because historically we had a very diverse landscape. And you may say, well, the grassland's not very diverse. Well, it is when you look at the actual species within that grassland. And a forest is very diverse when you look at the actual species, when it's maintained correctly or managed correctly.
When it's an actual woodland and not
closed
canopy.
When it's actual woodland. And that's a whole another, open up a whole another can of worms to go on. If you look at a landscape that gets dominated by one species, that's when you see, it may not happen right away, but at some point you see a lot of disease happen to where it's like, I would like to say, in my honest opinion, God's saying, this isn't right. Here's a disease, here's a bug, and 90% of these trees are going to die.
Because and what happens when those trees die?
Other stuff grows.
All of a sudden it's a, I mean, even in the timber where you see
ecosystem.
One tree die,
yep.
What happens? First thing that comes in, blackberry briars. Little sprouts.
Black raspberries.
Yeah, you start to see regeneration of other trees sprouting. I mean, that's...
Diversity is added. That's why when tornadoes happen, sometimes it's devastating. Hopefully nobody's hurt, no property's damaged. But when you see trees laid over, it's like, well, it's horrible, but the wildlife are going to flourish now.
You lose some timber value.
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah. That's why I'm a fan of cutting. Make the money while you can, and then improve the habitat at the same point. So there's the historical kind of background of edge feathering, but now we're going into or historical background of the landscape and how that relates with edge feathering and how we're using edge feathering, why we're using it. And so going into the two layers, let's talk a little bit about the layers. You've got a two-layer. I want every listener out there to picture your farm and picture your edges. 95% of them that you're going to find are going to be a hard edge. You're going to have crops, pasture, food plot, maybe old field, which that's a little bit better. And then big trees. How many times have you seen places that you've got more layers? And the layers could be as one layer is mature trees. And that's, you know, a mature forest, depending on species. It could be 40 to 60, maybe even 80 foot tall, whatever that is. And most of the time, it's going to be pretty even age. It's going to be, you know, you draw a line across the top. It's not going to vary much. It's going to all be pretty close to 40 to 80 foot. And then you've got the field, which is anywhere from lip high to 3 foot tall, to corn being 8 to 10 foot tall. And then harvested, so it's pretty much the same. And that's a two-layer edge. That's almost the default setting that you see with everybody's ground.
Even ours. We've got fields and food plots that still this day, and it's a product of we could go in an edge feather, but they're a lot of those on ours are because there's timber value.
And I'd say over half our food plots have a softer edge.
Yeah.
We're in a position where we need to cut some timber for harvesting, but we haven't
yet.
That's
what I'm saying. We've got some that are that hard edge.
But I think
it's a product.
It's very interesting, and we'll use some of our real-life examples here. But so you've got one layer of the mature forest, another layer of the field, crop, pasture, whatever it is. You can add other layers by forbs and grasses, and that's where you see a lot of these CRP contracts, CP38, various ones that are grasses, and that's that buffer strip. And they're using it for erosion control, and that's another big benefit of having edge feathering, to where you get these more herbaceous plants, grasses, and forbs around your perimeter. So
which
that's
also seen as a benefit. I've seen articles talking about the buffer strips having pollinators in
those. Oh, for sure.
And seeing an increase
in yield
in their crops because of the pollinators.
Yes. So you've got forbs and grasses, which could be another layer. You've got brambles, which could be another layer of, you know, black raspberry, blackberry.
Greenbrier,
various brambles. And so that's one thing. Another layer you could add to it.
shrubs. Obviously, by now they know how much we love shrubs, but you could have even sumac. But
I mean, you've got various plums, heights in the shrub
for
species.
Sure. You could have sumac, which, depending on what species of sumac, it could be a little bit shorter or taller. And then you've got plums, which can vary on age, or dogwoods even. American beautyberry. There's all kinds of hazelnuts. I mean, when the list goes on and on about shrubs. And then you've got young forests. So it could be as simple as just a transition from, when we say young forest, it could be a tree that's been stump sprout or cut or burned and top killed, and now it's only 10 foot tall. And that could range from 5 to 20 foot tall. And the brambles being from 3 to 6 foot tall, and the shrubs being from 3 to 10 foot tall. Forbs and grasses of 1 foot to 8 foot tall. And if you lay all that out, and if you were just to draw a straight line, look at a flat field, and you were to plant shrubs and you were to plant trees, and they were in the younger stage of life from 1 to, I don't even know, 15 foot year or 15 years old, and then you go in with brambles, they're all going to have different heights depending on the species, depending on their age, depending on how much nutrients they have. And if you were to slam all those together in between your food plot and your mature forest, you're going to have a very sawtooth staircase, a staircase with lots of steps.
And you think of it not just a step down with different heights as you come from the mature timber down. If you have different species, you also have various heights throughout that edge, throughout the steps. Some farther in is taller, some farther out is taller, depending upon the species that you have.
Yeah, and not only are you adding diversity to that area from height level, you add diversity for a whole long list of other things. With the forbs, flowers, you've got a diversity of insects that you're attracting, which are going to flower at different points of the growing season. So therefore, you've got different insects coming in to that area throughout the growing season. So if you have forbs that are flowering in April, or even the plums, the shrubs are flowering during April or May, they're attracting insects, which are providing food for bobwhite quail, turkeys, and other songbirds, and even other reptiles or amphibians, if you want to really go into that kind of management.
Which can be food for these other animals.
Which can be food for turkeys and quail as well.
This is the circle.
So you have more food available. And then, if you've got shrubs, they're providing, let's just say if it's a plum, it's dropping fruit in late summer for the wildlife, for the deer, especially if we really want to go back to deer management, dropping food during late summer, which could take some of your pressure, browse pressure off your food plot because now there's soft mass available. You've got flowering forbs, which could be food during early spring before your food plots have even germinated. So you're providing additional forage. You've got grasses, which can help provide cover year-round.
Yeah, fawning cover.
Fawning cover to late winter cover. And then you've got those same shrubs, which provided fruit during the growing season, are now providing woody browse during the dormant season. And all of that is...
And you hear this term thrown out, but... This is it can also be a thermal cover in the summer, protecting them from the heat, your quail and all that, but then also kind of a thermal cover in the winter as well, where it's, I mean, depending upon the species.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you go with a wide variety, diversity within your edge, and it may only be 20 yards, but there's way more diversity within that 20 yards than there is anywhere else probably on the landscape. And it goes with that phrase, dear creatures of the edge. How many times have you heard that? All the time. Is it because I think Dr. Craig Harper has done phenomenal with this way of thinking of, are deer really creatures of the edge? Or are they just on the edge more because that's where some of the best habitat is? And it kind of is a deep thought of going, are we wrong about saying deer creatures of the edge? Are they only there because...
that's where they can the best ability to survive.
That's where they have this diversity of benefits. Yeah. And that's where also you throw in what we said earlier about doing the edge feathering is not a 100% problem solver.
No. Nope.
You can't just do the edge. You have to manage that timber too.
Yeah.
You kind of have some of these diversity benefits throughout your timber as well, and not just in the edge.
It's a major you will face a problem if you go in and you plant a food plot and then you watch our podcast or listen to our podcast, watch a video, see a social media post that's edge feathering, you're like, I'm going to do some of that. And all of a sudden you go and do 20 yards around your food plots. Well, that probably just became the best cover on your place. And now you might kick out some deer every time you go to the food plot and you're like, I don't want them bedding on my edge.
Yeah.
Well, that might be the best cover.
If that's the only cover and the best bedding cover, they're going to bed there.
That's why I would definitely do bedding thickets before I did edge feathering.
Yeah.
Because you don't want them to be.
The picture you just posted here, was it yesterday?
Yesterday.
Of the edge that we cut. You posted the edge, but that's not all we cut.
Yep.
We went, it extends out to.
And that's kind of a next step. Like, I think, I won't even give information or an estimate, but the government contracts for edge feathering. It's like a set. It's very cookie cutter. It's like chunk. You just like stamp a spot on the field and say, we're going to edge feather there, and stamp a spot on the field there.
They count so many feet wide edge feathering.
So many feet wide edge feathering.
So many feet wide of edge feathering. And then they count it as an acre, as acres.
Yes.
Like they figure that out for feet of edge feathering and then feet of width and figure it as a set acreage.
Yes. And it's like one of those where it's just like a section, and you do like 50 yards on the edge of this field, and you go up another half a mile and do another 50 yards. And it's like, that's great. That's an attempt. It's a start, but it's not a complete project.
In effect, you still have a straight
hard
edge.
Yes. You have soft edge in a very section. That's why,
we can get into it now on the how we go about cutting the edge.
Yeah.
But a lot of our edge feathering is not I'm 20 yards off this field, I'm going to cut these.
Yeah.
I go in and this reinforces, you've said it a couple times the last couple podcasts, learn your tree species.
Yeah.
Learn your plant species. We walk in, it's like, okay, those offer me very little value at this height. I'm going to drop those. And I'm going to go 100 yards off the food plot if it's nothing but sassafras and persimmons that are so tall and dogwoods and stuff like that. If there's no crop tree, I'm going to go on past them. Yep. It may be a big strip into there.
It's like then, I said, think of I always think of Lake of the Ozarks. If you look at Lake of the Ozarks in central Missouri, you look at that shoreline, it's a very sawtooth effect. Like, you can just look and see little coves and little bays and little drainages dumping out. It's not a straight, it's not like Okeechobee Lake. It's a very sawtooth edge. And if edge feathering, when you're doing it, you may see a very sawtooth effect where if you find a pocket that goes 50 yards off, straight line away from the food plot that's junky timber, like you said, go cut it all. And you may find a big vein of really nice white oaks that runs almost to the edge of the food plot. You can leave those.
You may only have an edge feathering that's 10 yards wide, 5 yards wide.
Yeah.
Because there's a big tree right there that's a really nice tree.
And it may be raining acorns during the fall. And
I can guarantee you, if you do this edge feathering around it and reduce the competition, it's really going to drop acorns.
So you may have a food plot going right to the edge of this big white oak, but then 20 yards down, you've got a vein that runs 50 yards back that's just all cut. And it's a very soft transition. I mean, if you look at aerial images, satellite images, and you look at, you can clearly see field to trees in most places. But if you look at a property that's had some timbering done, I can think of a property pretty close to the family farm that had like a 6-acre clear cut 5 years ago, and 20 years ago there was a 10-acre clear cut. You look at that one, it kind of throws you a little bit for a loop going, I don't know what that looks like because it's varied in height. There's clearly a difference there, but I don't know if it's 3 foot tall or 20 foot tall. And that's why scouting with aerial images is tough, because you really don't know if it's 20 foot tall, 5 foot tall, 30 foot tall, 50 foot tall. And that's where with this edge, if you do edge feathering and you veined it out and you look at it, eventually 5-10 years from now, if you look at an aerial image of the farm, you would be like, ooh, that looks weird. I don't know what's going on there, but there's clearly a difference. And that's where the coastline or the edge of our food plots will look a lot different, because there is method to the madness.
And ideally, I guess, and this kind of touched on something we'd mentioned before we started, is ideally you would have these in stages to where, because yet again, this is another one of those things that you can't go in one time, cut it, and yep, I'm good for the rest of my life. This is going to be what we need for the rest of my life. This is one of those that ideally you would have various stages of edge feathering on, yet again, another diversity thing, but you could have various stages of edge feathering on every food plot.
Yeah.
And so you've got different stages, stuff that's just cut, stuff that's 5 years old, and have it to where you go back through and you're constantly, ideally you have it planned out to where you can go in, okay, this one I'm going to hit next year. I'm going to hit these edges next year. 2 years from now, I'm hitting these edges, and keep them to where they're constantly, you constantly have that change, to where you're setting it back.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you're going to hopefully set somewhat back with fire.
Yep.
But then you're going to have to go back through with a chainsaw and set a lot of those stump sprouts and stuff back.
Yeah.
Continually.
Because you don't want it to be forest. You want it to be diverse with brambles, grasses, forbs, shrubs.
You're going
to
have the stump sprouts again. You're going to have all of that.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, deer are going to browse your stump sprouts, but you hope that the deer herd's not so high that the stump sprouts can't.
And
that's a pretty good indicator that either A, the habitat is poor, or you have a high deer density, as if your stump sprouts in your edge feathering can't grow out of reach.
If your stump sprouts can't grow out of reach, you need to kill more deer.
Deer or put more food somewhere else on the property. Stop just planting food plots. Yeah.
And that's, it touches on another thing that we did a video day before yesterday. Where we cut the edge feathering that you'll release at some point.
Yep.
And kind of one thing you and I talked about is we don't like to cut everything. It's not a one swath, one cutting deal.
It's not a project that gets completed year one.
We like to go in and cut our edge feathering, but leave some of the trees for cutting later on.
That's
for
right.
For a year or two down the line. So you're constantly adding that fresh stuff to it. I don't want to go in one swoop, cut everything I want cut, and be done. I want to go in and I'll cut a pretty good chunk of it, but you leave some of those scattered trees, because if you're burning, you're going to end up just, by nature, you might kill some of them.
Yeah,
you might
do
some of that. You might go in later and realize, unlike some of them, if it's younger trees, I'll leave 4 or 5 there kind of close together that are competing with each other. And 4 or 5 years down the line, be like, okay, I want those two gone. They're the I guess, unhealthy trees of that group. I'm cutting those out and letting the others really go.
That's right. Yeah, it's like, how many times we saw this with, if you go into a piece of timber, and anybody who's ever put in a new food plot has probably seen this, but you go into a chunk of timber and you just doze out an acre and make a food plot. And all of a sudden, year 2, 3, you see these big leaning trees, boom, leaning way out in the food plot or falling over. And you're like, why are, it's like they were all weak or something. And it's kind of, could be a couple of things. And we talk about this a lot with heavy TSI, especially like when doing woodland restoration. You don't want to cut too many trees, because it's like a shock to the system for those trees to be like, whoa, where did all the sun come from? I'm not healthy anymore, because I'm a tree who's growing in the forest, and now I'm out here in the sun all by myself.
You see that, and I see that in Arkansas where I'm at, in our, we call them, they're a seed tree, And yeah. It's where they're knocking, it's mature timber that they're leaving scattered big pines throughout to theoretically reseed the area.
Yeah.
And you have those trees that have grown with competition with surrounding trees their whole life, that when you get rid of that competition and open it up, they don't have that support either. And a strong windstorm comes through and it lays a bunch of them over because they're used to having that support of all the trees next to them. Now all of a sudden wind comes through and they're not as strong. The root systems aren't as strong because they've grown up with that support all around them.
Yeah.
And it knocks them down.
Yeah. And so that's why staggering out your thinning. The first year we get pretty aggressive, but what we do is cut a lot of junk.
Yeah. I do that with just about all of our cutting. TSI, yeah. Everything.
Cut the junk.
To me, it's easier to go through and cut all of the junk that I don't want first.
Yes.
Because
you can create
that. Because your eyes to see the rest of the trees, what you want to cut after that.
Yeah. So year one, typically for us, is cut the junk.
Because you can nitpick your timber a lot easier once you've cut the junk out.
Yeah. It's hard. Like when you're looking at so many trees, so many stems, and it's all junk mixed with trees that could potentially one day be good, you're going, you almost get cross-eyed because you look at so many and you're like, I don't know which one. It's easier just the first year to cut all the junk.
And sometimes you can see within, for sure, 5 years, if you cut the junk out, you'll see those one trees that just blossom and just
yeah.
take off. And like, all right, that tree's left. That's staying. I'm cutting these three or four around it.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, that transition us into, we talk a lot, and our clients know this, closed-edge feathering, open-edge feathering. And in short, closed-edge feathering is cutting trees parallel with the edge of the field to create a barrier of trees to steer deer to where they have to use a different part of the field. You're creating almost a barrier or a natural fence to where they're going to come now. They're going to use the ends to enter the food plot. And that's a great way to steer deer closer to food plot. So if you're hunting a 2-acre food plot, a 6-acre food plot, and you're going, they always come back there and they use this whole edge and it's really hard to bottleneck them down. Well, close edge feather it. And now you create that barrier to where they don't want to walk through it, and you have a pretty good idea which way they're coming through now. We did that. Like, we've done that in the past where it's like, well, okay, they come out from three sides of the field. Well, we did a big J-hook edge feather, and now they come out from two sides or one side. And this is the beautiful thing about it. The deer still use the food plot, but now we've created – they'll use even the edge – of your edge feathering for winter browse. Like, they may use it for going into it and use the edges of it to browse during the winter months or early spring before food plots are growing and native vegetation is really taken off. But your rabbits, your quail, your turkeys, any of your other small game species can still use it. It may be closed edge feathering for the deer, but it's still phenomenal habitat for those other species.
And they can move freely as
absolutely
anywhere they want.
And that's why, and if you're using prescribed fire on the landscape, you may think, well, aren't you going to just burn up everything you just dropped? This is where we use hinge cutting a lot more than anywhere else on the property. We use hinge cutting with our edge feathering. We still don't hinge cut more than 50% of what we cut. I would say occasionally, if it's really important to get that barrier there, you might drop more than 50%, but that's only in a fence row type setting. You don't do a 20-yard wide off the food plot where everything's hinged, or you will create a wall basically.
Because even not hinging, just dropping it, it's a pretty good barrier that generally
yeah.
what we'll do, and like in the pictures that you posted of the edge feathering, you can't see it, but we went through, or I guess one of the other days, and part of it was because I could get through easier to cut the rest, but I cut trails through it, 2 or 3 trails through that stuff where we wanted the deer to come out.
Yeah.
And I cut multiple lanes going through that to where I was already seeing the deer are using those to
That's
come
right.
through, to come into the food plot.
Yeah, and it really is that easy. I think it's – I don't want to say it's a dead giveaway or it's just super easy, but it is one of the easiest ways to manipulate deer travel patterns.
We've done it in the middle of the timber.
Yeah.
Go in and do a line of trees and watched them walk around it.
Yeah.
Because they're generally going to take the path least resistance.
Yeah. They're lazy just like we are. And so that's where closed edge feathering can really be a great tool in your hunting strategy of going, okay, this is where I'm going to improve habitat for other wildlife as well as steer deer. And the deer still benefit from it. Another huge thing about edge feathering, and if you get this transition, is you want to picture if you're standing in the food plot and you're trying to see into the timber, if you have that two-layer edge, you can probably see back into the timber. But if you've created a 4, 5, 6-layer edge with all this different stuff, you probably can't see into the timber.
And the best way to tell it is think of it as if you've got a food plot that early November, you've got does really using that food plot. Would you rather the buck go 30 yards off in the woods, walk, look out in the food plot, nothing out there, move on? I mean, how often do you see deer do that?
Come to the edge
or stand, or they stand like early October when you're hunting, when you're on food sources. How many times do you see the deer that come to the 30 yards out of the food plot and stand in the woods and wait till dark and then come out?
Yeah, happens all the time. You hear stories like that a lot. Now, picture that same buck walk to the edge or stand back in the timber. He now can't see into the food plot. Better chance he's going to get to where he can see. So he walks to the edge. He sticks his nose out, and he's standing at the very edge of the forbs and grasses looking out of the food plot. Well, hopefully by this point, he's in range. You can take your shot. Or he's in another spot, he's a little bit out of range, you hit him with a little soft grunt, you pique his interest in that, he has to come find you to look into that food plot. Therefore, he works his way out. It's a lot more, you not only improve the habitat, now you've greatly increased your hunting strategy for success.
Well, the other thing you can do too is even if they, I mean, say, yet again, November, they're going to scent check that field.
Yep.
A lot of times they can walk on the edge and see, well, there's no deer there, and move on. If they can't see in the food plot, they have to swing downwind of that food plot.
Yeah, and if you're on
you
the
sitting?
Downwind side of that?
Downwind side of it.
Yeah.
In the travel corridor. And
that's
you're
right.
Picking them off as they're coming through. And I guess I was looking at that, what we cut the other day. One of the best ways is walk 40 yards off your food plot and look into it.
Yeah.
Can you see everything in it? You probably don't have enough edge.
Yep. And even when you cut, like, we're cutting right now when there's no leaves on the trees. Now, keep in mind, you think January, everything's dead, everything's dormant. It's just like, oh, it's a depressing time of the year. There's no food available. A lot of those understory trees, and even some of the, like, big mature hickories, are already having little buds forming. And those little buds turn into leaves later on. And, like, I cut that hickory yesterday. It had buds as big as bigger than a pencil eraser. That's food for the deer.
Yeah.
And the flowering dogwood's one of my favorites this time of the year. It's
oh,
got buds.
It's a big old bud on them.
Big old buds. And deer just devour them. Sassafras.
Within a day or two.
Yeah.
I mean, if I've been running a chainsaw a lot, I can count on the fact that the next time I go out there to cut, there's going to be deer tracks everywhere.
For sure.
I've seen it in the snow where if I've been in the middle of winter cutting, that's what they're looking for winter for woody browse.
Yeah.
And if I'm cutting, it can be in the snow and it'll be stuff that I cut the very next day. They've been there all night long.
That's right. Yep. And so we say that I've said this in the social media posts and videos on YouTube, but it's immediate food. Because of the amount of woody browse that you put in the ground.
It's high quality food, too.
It's high quality food. And it's also immediate cover. And so for like rabbits and even the deer, if you're cutting a bunch of stuff, there's immediate cover, there's immediate food. But it's also going to be, if you've hinge cut or even the stump sprouts are going to sprout back the next growing season. So you have food for years to come. But at the same time, as
you've got those trunks of trees, those treetops, even the stump sprouts. You've got cover for years to come. And because of the increased amount of sunlight hitting the forest floor, you've got other herbaceous plants growing to where you get more food and more cover.
It's a benefit for years to come and not just – and that's part of why, like, especially this time of year, I see you guys get a lot of questions about hack and squirt. You know, it's kind of been a big deal here lately. A lot of people talking about hack and squirt. Oh, hack and squirt the timber. It's safer.
Why not hack and squirt this? Okay. Yeah. It's easier. I can cover more ground. Okay, so people, let's dissect that.
And I think a lot of people, they look at cutting trees, and they think, well, it's just wood. I don't want my deer eating wood. I don't want them eating wood.
Yeah.
But cut a tree down, say dogwood. Cut a tree down right now and tell me, and take that last inch of the stem off and tell me that's wood.
Yeah. You think of, like, it's an axe handle. Like, it's not, it's very tender. It's very nutritious.
Those buds are full of moisture.
Tons of moisture.
Yeah. And it's like, you cut that stuff and they eat it the next day. And it's like, well, you know, or
let the deer tell you what they want to eat.
I mean, I could go, we've got standing beans in places right now. And I can guarantee you I could go right next to it and cut a lot of this down. And the deer would go and eat those buds.
They would probably eat them
every
before
time.
The
that's
soybean
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
They would key in on the stuff that I've cut over the soybeans.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like, we had clients, and I want to do this year, but whenever deer season's over, because it's not legal, but last winter they had snow on the ground. They went and dropped a whole cluster of different trees, understory trees. The understory trees typically have more buds than your big oaks, because the understory trees have to get that start early in the spring to make their blooms to flower before it's closed canopy and they're in the shade of the big oaks. So that's why you'll see that. But they cut a bunch of those understory trees and then they dumped a bag or two of corn out on the ground. And in the snow, they went back a couple days later. There was way more tracks around the woody browse than there was in the snow. At the corn pile, and that's because the deer selected that woody browse over the corn.
And that's not saying that they're not gonna eat that.
No,
but they eat diversity.
They do.
They eat a diverse diet. I mean, we saw it last year in Iowa when we were chainsawing, when deer were walking through standing soybean fields and pawing through snow to eat little forbs underneath the snow.
Yep.
Any green they could find.
That's the phrase that I've used 100 times. You can take a horse to water, but you can't make him.
They were in that TSI'd stuff, previously TSI'd stuff, and eating the woody browse.
Yeah.
And it's just like, they gourds on this stuff.
And so think about it like this. You've done the edge feathering. You've TSI'd your timber. You've done some bedding thickets. You basically have a plethora of food through your timber that's usually wasted space for a lot of guys. Then you add food plots to that. You've got to where the deer aren't focused just on your food plots to eat. Now it's the ice cream plant, so if it's there, they're going to come to it. But you're adding food on the ground, which herbaceous cover is phenomenal food during the growing season, late growing season, when that's one big stress level, late summer. Another big stress level is late winter, which woody browse helps fill that void. Herbaceous native vegetation helps fill the void during the other stress period. So you're adding food during two of the biggest stress periods, but at the same time you've got the ice cream plants, which are still going to be highly selected during hunting season.
A classic example is our fiasco food plot.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of work around that food plot in the last few years.
For sure.
There's a lot of woody browse. We burned it two springs ago.
I think two. Yeah, something like that.
So there's a lot of woody browse. There's a lot of fresh growth. We've really opened the canopy. We've never had, now we had a little bit of rain too, but we've never had beans like we did this year in that.
No. And we've never had deer activity we've had. Like Matt.
Late season. Matt. And that's the other side of it. I mean, we had deer really using the timber early when the beans were growing. So the focus was not solely on those soybeans. They were eating the woody browse a lot and allowing those soybeans to grow to when it did get droughty and a lot of our native browses started to get waxy. Then they started to eat the soybeans, but by then the soybeans had grown to the point that, I mean, we didn't have to have a fence. We didn't put an electric fence around them.
No.
Didn't need it. They focused on the woody browse until the soybeans were to the point where they could withstand the browse. And then flip it around to late season. There's still some growth in that. There's a few standing beans in there. But there's a ton of woody browse through the timber and a lot of cover to where the deer are using that. And then Matt has that hunt in that food plot.
We had a pretty good hunt there this year. Dad and I had a decent hunt there during gun season.
There's been a lot of deer activity in that this winter.
Yeah. No shock.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that's the same plot where we had the pictures of the rabbit bouncing along the edge. Now we had pictures of rabbits in almost all the food plots on the family farm, rabbits bouncing along the edge, because most of the food plots have had some sort of habitat work close by. Like you burned Deer Cane Ridge, Amarillo food plot had the burn, growing season burn there in late summer.
Yeah.
A lot of rabbits around that one. You go into Little Piney, that's like one of the softest edges that we have. That's oddly enough, and it's not so odd, but that's where I jumped the quail this year. A couple weeks ago, Dad jumped quail in the Fiasco food plot that you were
where
just
we've
talking
done
about.
So much work.
I mean, let the quail tell you where the good habitat is. If they're not there, the habitat's not good for quail, which means the habitat's probably not in the diverse quality to where what they would need to survive. And rabbits just all over. Kingsville food plot, rabbits all around it because you edge feathered the heck out of it this past winter.
Yeah.
And it's
one, like you talk about the rabbits in the same sense, and I think you kind of touched on it. You were going to share some of the pictures, but you tell me.
Why should a deer hunter care that there's more rabbits on the landscape?
Yeah. You tell me how many pictures, because you were the last, you went through the cards on the farm.
Yeah.
How many pictures of bobcats and coyotes did we have?
Quite a few.
And 5 years ago, tell me what our reaction would have been.
Oh, 5 years ago, we'd have been like, we need to trap. Get the traps out.
We got to get the traps out. We'd have been spending hours of our day. Instead of me chainsawing, we'd have been setting traps.
Yeah. And
you tell me what you saw those, what you see them carrying through.
Yeah, they're carrying rabbits. They're chasing rabbits. They're chasing rodents. They're looking for rats. And
there's rats. There's mice. And that's what it's telling to me. You look at the quail people, that rolling hills. Rolling plains out of
quail
Texas.
Quail Research Center
in quail
Texas.
Research. They've got a theory that they can base their quail populations, their future quail populations in the next year, on the cotton rat populations.
Yeah.
If they've got a lot of cotton rats, they expect to have a lot of quail.
Yeah.
Because it's tied into habitat, but then also their predators are focusing on the cotton rats.
Yeah.
It's like there's plenty of food.
I think, I don't know who coined the phrase, and I don't know, if I did know, I'd give them a credit, but buffer prey species. And that's basically the more rabbits, the more mice, the more voles, the more, what I say, rats and rodents, basically, small game species, small game mammals. They're buffer prey for coyotes and our other predators because they're going to chase those easier ones than go and try to run down an adult deer out of a food plot and grab
photo,
it by the neck.
Remember the photo series we had a few years ago with that rabbit that was just like hopping? You could see it, and it was like it hopped around, and it was like, well, that thing looks stupid, because then you see a bobcat in the picture.
Yeah.
And then it just grabs it.
Yeah, like, and that's what pretty close to this sequence of photos is. It's like it's just bouncing around, and rabbits aren't that smart. Like, they're just bouncing around at the edge of the food plot, and all of a sudden, boom, here comes a predator and snatches it up. That doesn't affect me. That doesn't cause my blood pressure to rise. That doesn't make me mad at coyotes because too much research has proven that regardless of how hard we trap, they're still going to be there. Like, you may knock a temporary void, and Kyle and Frank had an excellent podcast on this a few weeks back. There, you may knock a temporary void, but it's not going to be that long-lasting because they're just going to vacuum right back in.
It's the hole is going to be filled, too. I mean, we don't want to keep going on the predators because we could talk for hours on this, but other things are going to replace, say, possums and coons. They're going to eat skunks.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to eat snakes, some would say. They eat snakes.
Yeah.
Snakes are nest predators just the same.
And Kyle had another great blog. Go
yeah,
check out the blog.
Yeah, he mentioned that in the blog, didn't he?
Yeah.
That if you kill one thing, you're going to see another population increase.
What we do know is adding diversity on your landscape through plant communities increases the amount of holding capacity of your prey species.
I was going to say is we can circle right around to managing for quail as opposed to deer. You manage for quail, you're going to see these buffer prey species populations explode.
That's right.
Your rats, your mice, your rabbits, all of those are going to explode to the point where if you do have these other predators, that's what they're going to eat.
Yeah. And I would say this for a because this whole Land and Legacy and this podcast was created for more deep thinking in our game management, habitat management strategies. Because there's a lot of faults, there's a lot of holes in some of the modern day management. And one big hole is product endorsement rather than habitat endorsement. You see that too often. You see that too much with people and with mindsets of push a product rather than push habitat improvement. And one of the big ones that I see, like when we're talking about predators, we're talking about prey species, buffer prey species, is also the idea of overpopulation of deer, to where I question someone's overall holistic mindset if in one breath they breathe trapping and in the next breath they're breathing, I have too many deer.
Yeah.
Because that really is... It makes you think, well, if you need lower numbers of deer, why wouldn't your predators help you with that? So maybe for the next 5 years you don't trap and you just try to get the herd down. And once the herd's down, then you maybe think about trapping. Yeah. But don't do both of them at the same time, because I'm furious at does or I'm irritated because I have too many does. We need to shoot more does. But in the next breath, turn around and be like, we need to trap.
If you understand the predator-prey cycle, if you have a ton
been
of prey,
doing that,
you're going to have a ton of predators.
Yeah.
And that's what, like, turkeys, everything. When your prey populations explode, the product of that is that your predator populations explode.
Yeah.
I mean,
they work hand in hand, but at the same time, if you improve the habitat, you're creating a healthier ecosystem.
Yeah. And here's the thing: God designed a perfect ecosystem.
Yeah, that's the one that gets me. Like,
we're not gonna kill our way to a better ecosystem.
No, must kill management must stop. We must kill that management style, and must kill management is a whole other podcast. But it's the idea that you must kill predators, you must kill invasives, you must kill, and we preach killing invasives, but must kill deer, must kill weeds. And by weeds, I mean the common native weeds that we see in our food plots that we must kill. Must kill management is a mindset that you don't want to find yourself into, because your blood pressure raises significantly every time you go to the farm. Just appreciate the ecosystem and the predator-prey relationship the way God designed it. Don't think that you're going to change it. You can't play God. You can't play the management, the manager that can rule over. We're in the ecosystem. We're not managing the ecosystem. And by managing it, we're replicating nature. We're edge feathering. We're managing our timber. We're using these resources with us. We're not trying to manage over them and be the pharaoh on top of the throne. And so, getting back to edge feathering.
we could go off on tangents for hours.
I love edge feathering. So I asked you earlier, you rated it from a 7 to a 9, and I rated it an 8 or a 9. And the only reason I don't rate it a 10 is because it's not something that can be spread out over the entire landscape.
And that's
what
I don't think.
It's specific to these edge.
I don't think I would rate any habitat aspect
a 10?
At a 10 solely by itself.
Yeah.
Because it's the whole ecosystem depends on multiple facets of that.
Yeah.
You can't rate anything as a 10.
Yeah. It's like if you rate something at the 10, you say, well, why don't I put that over the entire landscape? Yeah. Well, if you did that,
you have no diversity.
You'd have no, like, if you said edge feathering is a 10, and it's like, okay, well, I'm going to create that over the entire landscape. I'm going to just get shrubs everywhere. That'd be a tough property to hunt. And because there would just be, there'd be really no rhyme or reason to where they were at, because they could move 10 yards and be in shrubs. and you couldn't manage it effectively. You couldn't have grasses scattered in throughout an entire 100 acres mixed with.
It'd be a nightmare to manage. Yeah, it would be.
I don't think it would be possible because the way the clock ticks, everything's trying to grow out of early succession into more mature stuff. So it wouldn't take many years and you'd have nothing but shrubs and young forest to, and then eventually trees. And your shrubs and everything be choked out. So I don't think you could do it, but edge feathering is an 8. I would say a solid 8 for me. And it really, it's so great because it's so great for many species and it's year-round benefits. But, you know, for me, I don't know, as we wrap this up, overall, edge feathering is a management tool that it's better habitat, it's better food, it's better cover, and it's better immediately once done. And if you went to your farm and you edge feathered on a weekend, 5 years from now, that impact is still felt.
Oh, yeah.
It's like I say, if you stop planting a food plot 1 year, the next year, it may be more annual weeds.
But next year is probably going to be really good.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be a bunch of ragweed.
A bunch of annual weeds that are very beneficial. But 3 years down the road, it just goes back into old field. And it may never even look like a food plot. But if you edge feather something, 5 years from now, it's still doing good. You never sent a fire through it, you never grazed it, you never went back and did routine maintenance to knock some of those stump sprouts down, it would still be a softer edge than what it was when you cut it. And that's why edge feathering is so great. That's why we're encouraging you guys to edge feather. Don't get bombarded or don't get overwhelmed with going, oh, I have way too much edge to edge feather. My advice for you is don't go and think I have to edge feather all my food plots this first year. Go do 50 yards along this food plot. Mm-hmm. Go do 50 yards along that food
plot.
That's
why I said I would rather have that where it's a diversity of edges in each one. And it's one, I mean, we suffer from it all the time. I get bored with cutting the same spot all the time.
Oh, hey, I don't enjoy it.
So, and that's why, like, around the farm, there aren't many areas that we haven't cut a little. Because it's like, I think I'm going to cut Burger Place today. I'm going to cut Big Piney today. I'm going to cut, and we jump around because then, again, we have diversity throughout.
That's right. So, guys, get out there and edge feather this time of year. Enjoy the journey. Enjoy the work. That's just, for me, transitioning out of – I enjoy this probably more than one deer hunt. Now, I enjoy a deer hunt in late October, early November, probably more than running a chainsaw for 2 months. But from September 15th to January 15th, that's deer season for us. That's archery season. Pick the bad days when hunting is poor, when the conditions aren't great, and go do some edge feathering, and your hard work will be long felt. So guys, go subscribe to YouTube, please help us out there, Land and Legacy. And once again, thanks for always listening. Thanks for always sending over your requests and comments on Facebook. We appreciate it. Instagram even, and we'll catch you next week.